This week, Swift Motion Pictures presents a gripping, unscripted, deep dive into the real-world forces shaping our communities through the lens of leadership, justice, and social transformation. Ramon Swift Sloan, visionary filmmaker and founder of Swift Motion Pictures, joins veteran host Earl Ingram for a powerful conversation that blurs the line in between documentary and dialogue. Together, they unpack the role of storytelling in movements, the power of representation, and what it truly means to lead on screen and off. This isn't fiction, this isn't scripted, this is cinema, but the conscious where real voices drive the narrative and the stakes couldn't be higher. What stories aren't being told? How can film reshape justice and inspire change? And what role do creators play in moving the culture forward? With raw honesty and cinematic vision, this feature-length conversation delivers both impact and insight, the kind of content that stays with you long after the credits roll. Now, streaming on all major platforms, presented by Swift Motion Pictures, where real stories become powerful cinema. Subscribe, follow, and stream at civicmedia.us or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. This is Earl Ingram and a continuation of the Earl Ingram podcast. I'm honored and privileged to have with us and you today, Mr. Ramon Swift Sloan. He is with Swift Motion Pictures. Good morning to you, young man. How you doing?
I'm great, Earl. How you doing, man?
I'm doing just fine. Tell us a little bit about Ramon Swift Sloan.
Well, a little bit about Ramon is I'm a motivator. You know, I like to inspire people.
No. Where'd you come from? How did you get to where you are? Let's introduce you to the people.
Well, I'm a native of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Born and raised here in the state. Went to Rufus King High School, Milwaukee Area Technical College for TV and video production. And, you know, I've always had a strong sense of arts, films, movies.
So before we get into all that, how old are you?
I'm 47.
You're 47 years old. You're from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You grew up where?
12th and Capitol.
12th and Capitol. So you grew up in the Rufus King neighborhood.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, the Rufus King neighborhood is an iconic community that has really spurned some really wonderful and powerful Black people. Even to this day, it is still as together a community as there is anywhere in the city of Milwaukee. Rufus King High School, which is one of the jewels of Milwaukee Public Schools, is where you grew up. So you grew up in a very successful community, very successful neighborhood. Mom and dad intact family.
Yes, yes. My grandparents, they moved here in on my mom's side in the 60s. My dad's side, I want to say, it might have been the 50s or early 60s.
Right, right. Yeah, it came here for the same reason that many others did, opportunities to work and live a middle-class lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, that neighborhood back then, I watched it change from going being like high middle class to what it is now. You know, as you know, a lot of homeowners, they probably passed the houses down to the kids. And, you know, a lot of them are now rental properties, you know. So it's a lot different over there.
It's still well maintained, though.
Oh, definitely. It is. It's very well maintained, you know, especially when you get past Capitol going towards going
east.
Heading north. Right. Yeah. So, it's a great neighborhood. You know, I went to Green Bay Elementary also. So,
how many sisters and brothers?
It's 9 of us total. My pops, he got 9 kids. My mom got 3.
Oh, you had a very small family. I'm from 13.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I kind of understand that, yeah. You know. So let's talk about you know, Rufus King, and certainly Rufus King is a place where, you know, they do a great job educating young people.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the people who get scholarships at Rufus King and wind up going to universities. Anywhere in this state, Rufus King can compete.
Definitely. And I don't know what the requirements is now, but when I was going there, you had to maintain a 2.5.
There's still high standards.
Wow.
Right, for the most part. Good. Rufus King, still high standards. Still, again, just a great place that cultivates young people. So it's no surprise to me that when you said you went to Rufus King, your success, it's certainly tied into what many other young people and families knew who sent their children to Rufus King High School.
Indeed.
So let's talk about, you know, what you did once you left high school.
Well, when I left high school, you know, I did a lot of things, you know, outside of me being in film. You know, that led me to, I was in the streets, you know, and I went from that to, you know, a short stint in prison. You know, and we talking 90s now, right? So we going back to 95. And, you know, fast forward, after that, that's when I went to TV and video production.
So we're going to get into all of that.
Okay,
you know, the fact that you were able to overcome a dark place in your life, to me, is worthy of a story being told. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you are able to overcome that, because many people and young people who are caught up in things don't overcome it, and it becomes defined by that and never able to change the trajectory of their lives. You were able to change the trajectory of your life. Maybe the stint slowed you down and gave you a chance to sit back and think about things. Did it have any impact, you think, on what you are doing now?
I would have to say, yeah. Because, you know, you do a lot of thinking.
Yeah, you got time to slow down.
And also, you know, you in the midst of you thinking, you're trying to figure out, okay, what direction do I need to go in? How do I get back on track to what I really should have been doing? You know, so I definitely would say that, because, you know, it was in that situation when I really fell in love with writing. And, you know, because before I got into films, I was an author.
You're a writer, right, author.
Yeah.
So how many different books have you written?
Five total.
So what were the books mainly focusing on?
Well, the books was...
Your life first, and...
It was loosely based on my life and a lot of individuals who I knew growing up in the neighborhood and, you know, my corner of the world. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you spoke about Rufus King, and you was telling me you had worked at A.L. Smith, because my first book, I talk about the transition of how Milwaukee moved from, you know, when we had a lot of those prominent great jobs at A.L. Smith and Briggs and Stratton, and how it changed a lot of the dynamics with families, people being displaced from their jobs and whatnot, and how it affected, you know, kids that may have not necessarily going down certain paths, you know, due to tribulations and trials that they, you know, that their families went through. I mean, because as you know, when they took a lot of those jobs out, you know, we talking late 80s, 90s and stuff like that, that's when a lot of things started to shift, specifically with families. You know, I mean, because, okay, you got displacement of people being displaced from jobs, you know, that's adding on to drug use that might have been there, but now somebody's doubling down on that. Then you got situations where neighborhoods are becoming dilapidated because these homeowners, they might not necessarily have the resources and the revenue to take care of these properties. In addition to, I mean, of course, there's always been issues in these neighborhoods. But when you remove resources from things such as income and whatnot, I mean, I watched it. You know, we watched it happen. So I talk about that in my first book a lot, about the guy who the book is about. His name is Keyshawn Watson. His mom, when he goes to Mississippi, then he comes back to Milwaukee, and his mom had a job at L. Smith. And then when he comes back, you know, that's done and over with, and he finds his mom and sister in a situation that causes him to make decisions that he probably shouldn't have made.
You know, so we're gonna move on, but I just think that it's critically important that we get that backdrop, backstory, mm-hmm. to who you are, how you got to where you are, and because it's critically important when you became an author. Were you a good student while you were at Rufus King?
I was a great student. Yeah, I was a great student at Rufus King. Maintained good grades. You know, I mean, in school was never a difficult thing for me. It was fairly fairly easy.
Right.
I never really had issues academically.
So was writing something that you did? Did you know that you were a writer? When did you find out that you were a writer?
Well, I probably found out I was a writer when I was, you know, in my mid-teens. I would say maybe 16, 15. But, you know, because I've always had imagination. And I would write out, you know, a lot of lyrics. I used to write a lot of rap lyrics,
right.
and stuff like that. And poems and whatnot. So I would say around that time in my life is when I realized that I had a gift for telling stories, you know, but it wasn't something that I was really like taking serious. You know, I was just a natural creator.
Right. So it's your gift. So if you're just joining us and being joined by Mr. Ramon Swift Sloan, here's with Swift Motion Pictures. Okay. So you start writing books. You wrote 5 books. That's a long leap from writing books to film.
Yeah.
How did you begin to even think that film was something that you wanted to do? What happened in your life? Because that's a major jump. You know, it costs a lot of money. It does a lot of research. There are a lot of things that go into becoming a producer of movies. I mean, where did that start?
Well, When I wrote my first book was entitled Motivation, and when I wrote that book, as I was writing it, I had it in my mind that it was gonna be a movie. So, you know, I'm envisioning this movie in my head while I'm writing this book, and when I went to MATC for TV and video production, it gave me an idea of what it would be like to make this, to turn something, what it would be like to shoot a movie. So I thought, right? Because what I quickly realized was a lot of the skills that I learned from the program, a lot of them were transferable into producing films, but, you know, it was a lot of it. It gave me it gave me the knowledge to understand terminologies and things like that in video, you know, such as storyboards and producing and, you know, what white balance was and the concept and understanding what an editor is supposed to do. But, you know, when you get in the field and you start shooting a movie, it's very different from, you know, being behind the camera when you're just talking about producing TV segments, because that's what it was mainly focused on. But as far as, like I said, it's giving me the skill set to understand what it was like. That was the perfect situation.
So listen, it's more than a notion. to go. Many young people go and take the courses and take the classes, and they never follow through to become a producer of movies. So it's more than a notion that to be able to make that into a reality, right? I mean, you pick those things up, but you didn't just leave them there. Mm-hmm. You applied them, and you were able to move forward. Did you have a family at that time?
Yes, I had a family. I had kids. You know, I had kids, and, you know, it was partially one of my motivating factors behind doing this, you know. And it was one of those things where it's like, okay, well, if I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do it. So I'm going to put my best foot forward, right? Because when I initially went to school for the video program, I thought I was going to be shooting music videos, you know. But that went a totally different direction, and here I am. So, you know, I was motivated by the idea of taking this book and turning it into a movie, because at that time it wasn't even by me understanding revenue from films. I didn't even know. And now we talking 2016, right? So I didn't even know what it was like to actually put a movie out, where it would go, who to take it to, how to get it monetized, how to get distribution, any of that. I was strictly just going off of the fact that I want to do this movie, and whatever happened after I do it, then that just happened.
So see, that's the part of it, the journey of it, yeah. And that makes people stop and pause and say, well, here's an average guy who certainly has some trials and tribulations in his life, was able to turn those things around, then have a dream and make the dream into a reality. That's an amazing story. And so even the first movie that you produced, costs a lot of money to put on a video, let alone are these four-length movies?
Yes, four feature.
Four feature movies with actors who don't do that for free, with all the people and all the technical people who are tied into it. Number one, trying to raise the resources necessary to make those things happen. So there's more than a notion, man. And, you know, and I know we got a limited time frame, but just to be able to make that happen for one movie from scratch is amazing, let alone for, what, 12?
Yeah, 12.
11, 12, 11 to 12 movies? Mm-hmm. So let's do this. That first movie, how long did it take before you were able to bring the vision and the idea into reality?
Well,
And put it on.
You talking from getting the script all the way into getting it?
Well, you had to write the script first.
Yeah. So putting the script together, that was the easy part, right? Just putting the script together, because I just went off of the book and it was all about understanding formatting and whatnot. But the blank period after that was figuring out how to get the money.
Yeah, let's be honest, man. You had a strike against you.
Yeah.
Right? Unfortunately, we have strikes against us from birth in this country, and let alone somebody who had, you know, a strike that most guys give up on and say there's no way. How are you able to overcome that?
You have to believe in yourself, and you got to go create opportunities for yourself. So what I did was, you know, once I realized that nobody's going to fund this movie, that I need to do it myself, then, you know, I just gathered up money from book sales. And at this time, I had got into real estate and bought my first property. I was learning how to use that and figure out equity and all that kind of stuff. And I was able to combine both of those and come up with the first budget, which was $25,000 for the first movie. And then we had some marketing dollars, which came well after that. So I was able to get it together, and I just took my shot and did it.
So first movie, $25,000. Clearly, it didn't wind up down on Marcus Theater's screens all over the world. You know, so you clearly didn't make a lot of money off of the first movie. Was there anything that said, hey, I don't want to do this again? Or what made you say, I'm going to stick with it? Because you were financing it with your own money.
Well, I would say that. So off the first film, what I did was we had a premiere, and I made a decent amount of money back off of that. And I think that probably put me close to the, I want to say, probably close to a little over the halfway mark. And after that,
of what you invested.
Yeah, what I invested. It probably was a little bit more than that. So, because we had a sold out show of, I sold well over like 800 tickets. And we had the theater, it was at the Oriental Theater, it's 2019. And it was at the Oriental, and we had over 600 people came out. So, you know, you're talking $20 a crack.
Right.
You know, and then I had one in Fort Walton and then some other places. But, you know, from that point right there to me getting the film put out, that was 2017 when I did the premiere. The movie came out in 18. So, when I released it, you know, I didn't, at this time, you know, we have a lot of films on Tubi right now, but at that time, everything was going to Prime Video. And when we released it, the first check, I want to say it was like $12,000-$13,000. So I'm like, you know, I didn't even think we was going to get, it was going to get that back. But when I started to understand, okay, the rates and how you make money off Amazon and all of this. And then at the time I'm dealing with a distributor, they was explaining like how you go to different platforms and it's like, okay, this ain't just that. We're going to go to other places and we still going to, you know, get more revenue. So then when Tubi came along about a year and a half after that, and then I put it on Tubi and made more money than I got off the first check. So at that point, I just started to understand like, okay, the business of streaming, because all of this was, it was a new concept to the entire movie industry. And, you know, when I started to understand that, I'm like, all right, well, maybe if I figure out ways to continue this and keep doing it, you know, it'll make sense. And that's pretty much what I did. So, you know, we went from that, and the next project was The Rise and Fall of Cuckoo Cal. We did that documentary. And documentaries, they don't really do well, you know, just because, I don't know why, they just don't do well. Not independent, just all documentaries.
Right.
They don't do as well as full features. But we did that, and that was more of a look for the city and, you know, just to give Cal his flowers and, you know, to do a collaboration with the other producers I had on the project with me. But by that time, I had a pretty good understanding of what movies was about, and we was gearing up to shoot part two, Circumstances 2. Now you're going to 2020. And I was at a place where I understood the numbers and I understood how to actually make these movies and make them make sense, but I really didn't understand what the audience wanted.
So, man, you go from the second movie in 2000, first movie 2016, mm-hmm. second movie 2020, and now people can say that you're a prolific producer because now you're up to 11. So something changed clearly mm-hmm. from 2020 to 2025 because now you've produced 9 additional movies yeah. in that time. What did you see? What clearly the market is, you can look at Tubi and all these other different areas and markets, and they've got so many different outlets. I've got what is it? Some kind of, my wife has some kind of television thing that we have TV. Well, I don't know what it is, but they've got 16,000 channels on it. And each one of them has some opportunity. So the market is safe to say fertile.
Yeah.
For independent films being produced. Would you say that?
Definitely. It's a revolutionary time for the whole industry, you know, and even a lot of people in the small sector of Hollywood, a lot of those producers and actors, and a lot of them are breaking away from that system because of what streaming has done. It's created a way for where you don't really need gatekeepers. I mean, of course, if you take a project to a producer in Hollywood and Sony, they can give you a budget that you wouldn't necessarily have on your own, but you wouldn't own the IP.
They have oversight of it, yeah.
You know, and it's, but it's like, if you have the know-how and you are willing to take a pay cut and you're willing to utilize all your resources that you have, you can make a good living doing this.
Okay, so clearly 11 movies and counting. Do you use the same actors and repeatedly, or are you searching for new actors all the time?
Well, it's always, you know, Earl, it depends on the type of
film that
that we're looking for. And a lot of times, of course, you know, you're dealing with people that you have chemistry
relationships
with,
right?
You know, so, and it just keeps the process going faster. But there are times, you know, more often than not, when I'm looking for new faces, especially in Milwaukee, you know, because we shoot these films here to give people a chance to shine, not only that, but also just to collaborate with individuals who we think are good at what they do, even if they don't realize it.
So are you single-handedly writing all these different scripts and movies, or do you have a group of people who work along with you?
I have a team of writers who we write these things together. So typically what I do is I come up with concepts and, you know, I'll write it out, come up with an outline or something, and then get that over to who's ever writing, they're going to be the key writer on it. And then they start putting it together, and then we go to making the edits and deletion.
So what's the gist of the majority of your movies? If I was to say to you, what message you're trying to get across with the movies, is it safe to say there's a correlation between all of them?
Yeah, I would say typically, I mean, we have our movies, they cross different genres, you know. Drama is the main focal point, but we have drama romance, drama crime, drama thriller, psychological thriller, different themes, but a pretty strong piece of our catalog, even within like A Good Day for Everybody, that's more of a, I don't know if you want to call it a social justice piece, but it's a probably would be more of a thriller drama. So even across the board with all of our movies, generally, you know, it's always a message, some type of message in the film, whatever film it is, you know, because I choose to take these opportunities with these movies to enlighten, you know, spark conversations, get opinions going. And
so is it safe to say that at the root of most of them is entertainment or a message, a story, that a combination of both?
I would definitely say it's a combination of both. You know, we aim to entertain. You want the audience to be entertained, but you also want these pieces to be thought-provoking. You want it to be things, and it might be thoughts that I don't necessarily agree with. They might not necessarily agree with the art, but it at least it has a person thinking about something versus them just, okay, I just went and watched a movie and that was this, and I was like, okay, whatever, when they done with it. But when you have somebody that watched this film and they walk out of the premiere or they turn the TV off from watching it, and they have a conversation with each other about it. Like, well, I don't know if she should have did that or he should have did that, and I would have did this. You know, you don't have that a lot of times in movies, even with a lot of big production movies. If you go see let's say a Rambo, Expendables, or you know, it was a movie I just went and seen, Accountant 2. You know, you it's a lot of films where you just go sit in there and be entertained.
Right.
And they really don't make you think when you turn it off. But I would venture to say that the majority of our catalog, it has that effect on people.
So my guest is Mr. Ramon Swift Sloan. He is with Swift Motion Pictures. So I want to say to you, it's pretty safe to say right now you're a prolific movie producer.
Appreciate
you know,
that.
So, well, come on. The numbers speak for themselves inside of that four-year period, the last four-year period. So what is it that do you just, your mind just clicks on something, what your next movie is going to be? Or do you ever take a breather and say, you know, maybe I'll focus on something different? Or is it just a continuation of things that have happened? You look in our community, in our neighborhoods, your generation, young generation, and it certainly has stories to tell. The generation after yours has stories to tell. The generation before yours has stories to tell. So do you focus more on your generation in these movies, or do you ever think beyond that?
Well, I focus on, I don't necessarily focus specifically on
any generation,
but what I do is, like right now, I probably got 30 different movie ideas in my notes. You know, if I see something and I'm doing something in it, and I'm moved to have a thought about, wow, this might be something dope if we could actually turn this idea into a film. So if it's something that I think I try to do original pieces where, you know, obviously anything you're dealing with, somebody's gonna be have touched on the idea prior, but the overall concept, I try to figure out ways to produce things that a lot of people may have not touched on yet. So, and you know, I think that a lot of these things is concepts that could affect or speak to all generations, because these are, you know, a lot of these things, you know, like when with A Good Day for Everybody, it deals with police murder, unjustified police murder. I mean, we've been going through that for how long since slavery, right?
Right.
And then you have Untangled, which is a guy dealing with a situation where he's married and he's trying to be a good husband, but he has you know, a mistress or whatever, or a second woman or whatever you want to call it. Okay, that's been going on since the beginning of time. You know, then you take All About a Check, that series, and it's primarily focused on people's morality and forgetting morality and integrity when chasing a dollar.
So you've been able to, in many instances, just looking at the sheer numbers, produce a couple, two, three movies in 1 year's time. That's an unbelievable pace. How are you able to maintain that?
Having a good team. And once you create a blueprint, I'm sure you know this, Earl, you've been dealing with radio for how long? Once you create a blueprint for something and you get a system and you get yourself a creative format, then all you just have to do is keep following that system. And in the midst of you doing this, obviously you're going to have to make some revisions to your program here and there, but you just got to go with what's working for you, have a solid team around you, and you know, that's probably going to take you working with a lot of the same people.
So do you set a budget up before or after you get started? Okay, so it sounds, you know, because I don't know and the people listening don't know, but you just would wonder, before you begin to start a quest for a movie, you got to think, how much is this thing going to cost? Where is it going to come from? Can you start a movie without having the budget solidly in place, or is that a recipe for disaster?
It's 100% a recipe for disaster because you just want to know what you have access to. I mean, because you got to think, when you're putting your budget together, you also that's in pre-production. You're also going to be putting together all of your pieces in terms of who's going to be working on this project
right. with
you. So all of these people are coming with daily rates. So you have to understand how I structure my budgets. That, you know, with doing this for so long, you're going to know what your core budget is going to be, and that's going to be your crew, right? So that's going to be your cameraman, all of that. That's the core budget. And outside of that, now you're dealing with actors, right? So if you want to put someone with a face on there, then that's going to be a big piece of your artistic budget, what I call it. And you definitely want to go into it and say, okay, look, we got $100,000, $110,000, whatever, $120,000. For this movie, if we go under that, then fine. If we can't go over that, right? So you definitely want to have that in mind in the beginning. You know, the way we work now is we have an entire network of actors who we deal with, and we pretty much know. You know, if some of them are negotiable on their rates, if some of them aren't, if it's worth paying them more than what we paid last time, it just depends on, you know, what type of response we got from the audience when we dealt with them in the previous films. So you want to take all that into consideration, but you definitely want to go in before you turn them cameras on and you start shooting that your production comes. You want to have a bottom line.
So a couple other things. So you own all of your equipment.
I own some of my equipment, and
because that stuff is really, really expensive.
Yeah.
You know, and with the technology continuing to ramp up, you want to kind of use the latest technology. Mm-hmm. That's a cost. You know, got to be a tremendous cost, but that all that's got to be figured in.
Yeah. So how I work my way around that is a lot of times you're going to find if it's a camera person.
They've got their own camera.
Bingo. If it's an audio technician, he's probably going to have his own audio stuff.
Right.
So, you know, that helps. Otherwise, what you would have to do is if you don't have it yourself, you got to go rent it. And that's going to add more to the budget. But if you have somebody who they have this equipment already, you're going to save a lot of money. Now, some people, they make you rent them and the equipment.
If they're good enough.
Right.
You pay the rent.
But from an independent standpoint, Earl, that's not a good model because that might work for someone, you know, Tyler Perry or something like that, but an independent artist, that's going to, in the long run, you're going to lose so much money with that, using that form.
So you've been at this now how many years?
Next year, make 10.
It gets easier.
Definitely gets easier after a while. Because it's just like riding a bike. You know, once you learn the process, and, you know, it can begin to get stale as well. If you don't find ways to challenge yourself.
Have you been able to bring in investors or not looking for investors?
No, I haven't been able to bring in investors. I don't look for investors right now because
This way you can control.
Yeah, and it is just something that it doesn't really make sense for me at this stage and what we're doing. You know, I have partners on some of my projects, but as far as outside money, no.
So where do you see yourself 5 years from now, 2030?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know, because the catalog that we've been able to build, I actually didn't think we was gonna do it in this time frame. So, but one place where I definitely would like to be in, we're definitely gonna be in, is at building bigger pieces of medium, having a studio, and creating a space for other filmmakers that's coming up in the game to be able to show them how they can do this better than what we've done.
So it eludes my mind. No studios. You're familiar with no studios?
Yes, I'm very familiar with no studios.
Have you been able to do any premieres or anything with no studio?
Well, we premiered A Good Day for Everybody there. And I've done many different, I did a mixer for A Circumstance of Four. I've done a lot of work there. You know, I've worked closely with a lot of people at No Studios. So a lot of my creative teams, they are housed there. So yeah, I'm very familiar with that space.
So if you... Since we're here, and there'll be many people listening to this, and what would you say to people who might want to travel the road that you've traveled to, who want to be creative, who want to follow your footsteps in doing this? What would you say to someone who wants to kind of get engaged and involved in the game?
Number one, I would say get a mentor, someone who understands the business and they're willing to give you pointers on all their shortcomings, because you don't, it's a lot of blunders and things that I went through that I could have avoided if I would have had a mentor, and it would have saved me hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I would say, having a mentor that you can work closely with that can give you the information, and just understand that this is going to be one of the hardest things you ever done, because just you putting this money out for these films and you're waiting months and months on end to get a return back. I mean, it might some of these situations you might not see a dollar back for 15 months. So you definitely gotta understand that this whole situation, if you're in it for the long haul, that's exactly what it is. That you plan the long game. So when you're talking about being able to fund your projects off of your projects, that's gonna come from you having a catalog. You know, that's gonna come from, because you know, if you produce a project, you put it out, and that first year is when you're going to make probably the best piece of money off of it. But after that, then you still, it's just like having a rental property, just residuals.
So people think people who are making movies all drive Rolls Royce Phantoms. And, you know, they see this on television and movie theaters, and they say, you know, everybody's wealthy beyond imagination who's got involved in this. What would you say is the reality? Because I got to believe for every one person who strikes it, you know, Spike Lee, mm-hmm. there are millions of people who are attempting to get involved in this. They need to understand it's more, it's difficult, to say the least.
Yeah, it's the whole industry of arts is the, I would say it's probably more than likely, I would say it's the toughest industry that you'll ever embark upon to try to be successful, because the whole world of art is all based on, it's subjective, and it's what's funny to you might not be funny to me. What's a good movie to you might not be a good movie to me. Music, all of that.
The eye of the beholder.
You know, right. So with that being said, then you have to understand that's why it's only literally probably 20% of actors are successful. And I don't even think it's that much. So, and why is that? Because once people find success in this industry,
they stick with it.
They typically kick, exactly. They typically circle around those same individuals who they found that success with. And you can't really knock them because it's difficult. And once you find that formula, you just want to keep repeating that formula, rinsing and repeating.
Man, the amazing thing is there's so many great actors. I mean, just endless, right? They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. But do they get an opportunity? As you stated, it's what's so difficult. And everybody's not going to be Denzel.
Yeah.
Right? There's only right. A couple of them, right?
So if we all understand everybody's not going to be Denzel, then we have to ask ourselves, why am I getting in this? You got to understand that everybody's not going to be Denzel. Everybody's not going to be Steven Spielberg. Everybody's not going to be Jeffrey Bruckheimer, right? But you have to be comfortable with saying, why am I in this industry? Are you in this industry to make a social impact? Are you in this industry to feed yourself, feed your family? Do you just want to be famous? And when you understand that aspect of it, that's what's going to be your why, right? So if you're getting into the movie industry to say you want to be the next Denzel, I wouldn't even recommend a person to do that solely based on that, because you might end up being disappointed. But if you want to say, I'm not putting any ceilings on myself, I can do whatever it is I put my mind to, I can be better than Denzel, but in the midst of me doing that, I also need to have some other whys in there, and I need to put some safeguards in there also. Not to say that you got to have a plan B, but we're in a totally different world now where you can control a lot of what you're doing. And how could you do that? What's the best route for somebody to be the next Denzel in my eyes is to take control of the creativity of it. You know, own the project, get behind the camera. You know, back when Denzel was doing this, he didn't have access to the type of system that we have now independently. So he might not have went that difficult route if he had access to this. So a person has to understand that you have access to control your own destiny, and that's what I would recommend.
So I want to say, man, thank you very much. It's been an entertaining and very thought-provoking interview with you today, Mr. Ramon Swift Sloan of Swift Motion Pictures. Congratulations. Good luck in the future. And maybe we'll cross paths again with this.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's it. That's a wrap.
All right.
All right.